From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm your host, Kennedy Vinson. Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. We're bringing you interviews and in-depth stories connected to Black and immigrant communities in Central Illinois. We start today's dialogue by taking a closer look at the film industry. We're speaking with filmmakers, the CEO of Ebert Fest, a local film festival, and a trailblazer and Black man in the film industry. Malcolm D. Lee. At Ebert Fest 2024 in April, people screened Best Man and heard from Malcolm D. Lee at a panel discussion.
Harper, why'd you really leave your girl at home this weekend?
Because I wanted to hang out with the guys. You know, cut up with the boys before she came.
When Harper Stewart agreed to be the best man at his best friend's wedding. It was a reunion of old friends.
Well, well, well. The gang's all here back in effect.
But before the happy couple can walk into the future,
I'm gonna go blind just looking at it.
They'll all have to confront.
You read my book?
No.
The secrets of their past.
We're talking about fictitious accounts of experiences that I've gone through.
Ooh. Tay Diggs, Nia Long, and Morris Chestnut. The Best Man.
Can we at least hold each other?
Did that sound familiar? It's from the film Best Man. It's been over two decades since the movie came out. I spoke with Malcolm D. Lee, the director of Best Man, Girls Trip, Space Jam, and more. He calls The Best Man a dramedy and a life movie. It turned into many sequels like The Best Man Holiday and The Best Man Final Chapters. Malcolm Lee talks about how the characters are relatable to this date and how the movie stands the test of time. We discuss the lack of Black representation in the film industry in the late 90s.
Particularly when it comes to Black audiences, there's a reflection that The Best Man offers.
And how The Best Man became a classic, creating a huge footprint in the film industry for Black representation.
Thank you for having this dialogue with me, Malcolm.
Hi, Kennedy. No problem. No problem. My pleasure.
The Best Man is celebrated for its authentic portrayal of African-American relationships. How do you think the film's themes and characters resonate with audience today, over two decades since its release?
Today's audiences would relate to it. You know, I think it is a good representation of 20-something post-college graduates who are aspirational or upwardly mobile. They are not inaccessible people. They're very relatable. I haven't watched the movie in some time. I pretty much have like the most recent references, but I think when I set out to make The Best Man, I set out to make a movie that I thought would be evergreen and stand the test of time and be regarded as a classic. And so it is largely regarded in that way, certainly by the audience it was intended for.
Definitely. And I think it does stand the tests of time. I think a lot of people could speak to that. I also want to ask, Ebert Fest often celebrates films that spark meaningful discussions. What messages or themes do you hope viewers can take away from The Best Man after seeing it at the festival?
Well, I mean, if they haven't seen it already, and I think it'll be a good kind of like nostalgic trip down memory lane. I think that thematically we took on themes of like friendship and forgiveness and unrequited love, commitment, and what it means to be committed to a relationship, whether that be platonic or romantic, and what are the depths one might go to preserve that relationship. It's all relatable stuff that resonated then and it will still resonate today. I mean, I think, you know, particularly when it comes to Black audiences, there's a reflection that The Best Man offers that I think there wasn't a lot of in the late 90s when the movie debuted. You know, I think there's more of it now, but I think people still want to have a certain wish fulfillment when they, you know, go to movies and have, a certain escapism. But I wanted to be escapist, but also people could see themselves, like I said, a reflection of their own lives. That's what people will take from it.
With The Best Man, you tackled a blend of comedy and drama and, like you said, friendship and forgiveness. How do you approach balancing these elements in your storytelling process?
You always got to start with tone. When I made The Best Man, I knew that it would have humor and that there would be some funny stuff in it. And I think life can be funny. For my entire life, really loved to laugh and loved being around funny people or people that make me laugh. And I enjoy making other people laugh. Life is not always laughter. My approach is to make sure the characters are grounded, that the situations are grounded, and that you have to push your characters in these environments and scenes and put pressure on them in order to get kind of the best storytelling. But I always start with a very grounded premise, direct from there. Sure, I want laughs at times, but it should be within the context of the characters' dynamics. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, I remember early on the studio and even one of my producers was like, hey, this is a comedy. And I just said, this is not a comedy. It's a drama with comedic moments.
This is time. Marriage is sacred. My folks been together 35 years.
I hear that.
Besides, marriage is going to curb that appetite for more women. In case y'all didn't know, marriage is a cure to promiscuity.
In what world?
You said that, man. You would have never known that you graduated summa cum laude. You say some dumb...
Oh, man, there's a time for everything, players. We're in the real world now, man. The real world, real things.
I think over the years, The Best Man has been characterized as a number of things. Comedy, dramedy, romantic comedy. Somebody even characterized it as a bromance. All those are valid, depending on who the viewer is. But like for my approaches, to treat most of these things like a dramedy or a drama with comedic elements.
I want to talk more about that groundedness and your process with creating these characters. And also, again, just bringing up these themes of friendship and forgiveness and love and personal growth. How important is it for you to explore these universal themes within the context of the African-American community and culture?
The thing about Best Man, any movie that I've tried, most of the movies that I've tried to do, if not all, you know, have had universal themes. And that's kind of been my mission in the business, is to make the so-called African-American film universal, to normalize Black life in America and in the world, quite frankly. So you put cultural specificity with it so that it feels like anyone, universal in that you want everyone to be able to relate to it. Cultural specificity because, you know, that's what gives us the flavor that sets it apart from other stories. If I can watch and enjoy My Best Friend's Wedding or Muriel's Wedding or Four Weddings and a Funeral or even My Big Fat Greek Wedding, there's no reason audiences of any culture can watch and relate to The Best Man. So that's very important to me. And, you know, whether it was Best Man or Space Jam, A New Legacy, or Welcome Home, Roscoe Jenkins, or Roll Bounce, or Girls Trip, these are people. And, you know, I want to display certainly their cultural specificity, but I want to have the universality of their humanity.
In your journey as a filmmaker and a Black man in this industry, what challenges have you faced, if any, when bringing any of your films to screen? And how did you navigate those obstacles?
The business is ever shifting. I've tried to, you know, maintain integrity where I can, try to do stories that I'm passionate about. And sometimes I see opportunities, if I do this movie, then such and such will happen. I think it's not just black and white. I look at some movies that get made, and I'm just like, man, white people can make movies about anything they want. We have to be kind of specific. But then I'm like, also like, well, you know, at times I do see movies that and television shows that feature black talent. And I'm like, oh, that's different and that's new and that's unique. There are movies that I tried to get made that couldn't get made because they were too expensive or they were black and expensive or black and what they felt was a niche market because it was, you know, in sport or it's just a sports thing. Fortunately, like, I've been able to navigate the landscape pretty well. Sometimes things take a long time to set up and to come to fruition. So it's a process, and I've learned a lot along the way. Every year, I learn something new, and the industry learns about itself, acts accordingly, and it's all really what audiences are going to gravitate toward. Or not gravitate toward.
Speaking about what's new and up and coming, and you mentioned, oh, this is interesting, and this, I never thought about this. What are some things that inspire you that you've seen recently?
I'm encouraged and inspired by my own development at my company. I see a lot of good ideas that we're developing and are coming to light and that are coming to fruition. I'm encouraged by that. I think we have some great projects on the horizon.
How do you see the role of festivals like Ebert Fest in shaping the future of cinema, particularly for independent filmmakers and diverse voices? And then what would be some advice that you could give some aspiring filmmakers from diverse backgrounds?
Festivals are great platforms to create awareness. If you make some noise at a festival, either by winning it or creating some kind of buzz, it's meaningful to your growth to show like, okay, people are responding to the work that I'm doing. Lots of times there are financiers, executives, what have you, at these festivals, or that they hear about it. Buzz is always good. They're always looking for what's going to attract a new audience. Who's that voice out there that's going to shift the industry? Because listen, the industry is contracting and shrinking, and they're still trying to figure out who they are and what they are again, streaming versus theatrical. And do you do day and date? Do you do an exclusive window? Is this a streamer project, or is this a theatrical project? And they always want new voices that they can cultivate.
Mm-hmm. And according to the 2024 Nielsen study, nearly 55% of Black Americans watch broadcast television, especially as their main source of media.
We've seen so much change too, like you said, streaming versus theatrical. How do you see the film industry shifting with where society is kind of going?
You just never know. Right now, it's a lot of people are getting their content from streaming. They want to watch their entertainment when they want to watch it, when it's convenient for them, on their phones, on their tablets, on their computers, or right there, you know, in the comfort of their own homes. So I think that's still like very much the generation that is my children's generation, and the generation that's like, you know, right after me. They like the convenience of their entertainment. And streaming is taking a hit because they're not going to do the same things they've been doing. Like I said, there's a lot of contraction going on. You got to watch what the trends are. I mean, that's what I did with Best Man. When I first came out with it, I knew that wedding movies were very popular. And the thing with Best Man, I never even intended to direct it when I first started writing it. I just said, I'm gonna write something so commercial, I'm going to sell it. And I'm going to use that money to make an independent movie I was trying to make. But there hadn't been a Black wedding movie. So let's make it a college reunion. Black people who graduated from college aren't always, they're always caricatures of Black people, of educated Black people, rather than, you know, Black people that I went to school with. So I was very, very calculated about what I was trying to do and what the box I was trying to check. So I think that still remains the truth today. Like, okay, what's number one on top 10 movies on Netflix? What's top 10 movies at the box office? Do I have a movie like that within me? Can I do that? Shoot for that.
I wanted to bring back a part of the conversation from earlier. You were talking about Black life in America, but also the world. What else would you like to see coming out in the film industry?
I still want to see more diverse stories from Black people's perspective. And I mean, you know, Black people from all over the world. There's still very much untapped stories that have been yet to be told, whether they're historical or have some kind of historical context that can resonate today. Black faces in many different genres, action, comedy, thriller, drama. You see some of it, but doesn't always get seen.
Can you share any memorable behind-the-scene moments or like anecdotes from the making of the film?
I remember the cast we assembled was very excited to be there. When we had our last rehearsal before we started production, I've been doing this since film school. I get everybody in a circle, I hold hands, I ask for God or whatever higher being anyone prays to ask for guidance and to bless the production. And I remember Terrence said, Lord, let us, you know, do our best work, and that let the world see that Black people are more than just what they've seen to date. And I thought it was beautifully said, and it's exactly what the right message was.
Thank you, Mr. Malcolm Lee, for joining us on Dialogue today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Dialogue from Illinois Soul, which talks about stories from Black and brown communities in central Illinois. I'm Kennedy Vincent, and we just spoke with the director of the Best Man film, Malcolm D. Lee. We're continuing our dialogue with Chaz Ebert, the CEO of Ebert Fest. She tells us this year's Ebert Fest may have been the last.
We don't know if there's going to be another Ebert Fest.
This is Dialogue on Illinois Soul. Stay with us after this short break.
listening to Dialogue from the all-new Illinois Soul, which talks about stories from Black and Brown communities in Central Illinois. I'm your host, Kennedy Vincent, and we just spoke with Malcolm D. Lee, director of Space Jam, The Best Man, Girls Trip, and more. We're now pivoting our conversation to talk about Ebert Fest, a local film festival many Champaign-Urbanans are familiar with. It's been going on since 1999, and it was founded by the late Roger Ebert.
Welcome. I am so happy to see you all back at Ebert Fest. It's been 2 years, I guess, since we've seen each other.
I spoke with Chaz Ebert, Roger Ebert's wife and a fellow film lover. Chaz Ebert and festival director Nate Cohn have been helping curate the film festival since the beginning. I spoke with Chaz, and she had some unfortunate news to share.
I made an announcement that we don't know if there's going to be another Ebert Fest.
Chaz and I discussed the process of bringing in diverse voices for the film festival and what engagement looks like from the community. She also highlighted that after each film in Ebert Fest, they host a panel with the film directors and team. We spoke about the selection of content and advice she'd give to voices of color in the film industry. This year, one of the films that was shown was Albany Road. It was directed by Christine Swanson. She's a Black woman director. The film is starring Lynn Whitfield, and for many people is a household name actress. Let's listen to the director on some of the fun facts she could share about Albany Road.
90% of it was filmed in Champaign. One of the things that inspired me from filmmakers like Spike Lee and like Charles Burnett is to see our images on screen in a way that was transcendent. I feel like the industry is slowly coming along, but I think for a long time it hasn't really serviced or been ready for elevated storytellings with and by Black women. Black women in the marketplace always overperform. What I witnessed in the Black community was this great well of humanity that just went above and beyond what's normal. We should have a balance of storytelling because that's democratic. That's the American way. I feel that we've only scratched the surface of what's possible in terms of storytelling that has people who happen to look like us.
Later on in the conversation, we'll hear from one of our executive producers, Nidhi Shastri. She sat down with the Little Indian Girl Collective, who created the film Promises of Our Grandmothers.
The entire world is standing up, and at some point, they can't fight the whole world. So you just got to remember that. And we actually do have the power and have the ability to make change. I mean, that's very clear, as we've seen through history.
I sat down with Chaz Ebert on the increase of diverse voices in film and the global perspective that's currently shifting. Chaz, thank you so much for joining us on Dialogue today.
Well, Kennedy, thank you for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here with you.
Thank you. We just wrapped up Ebert Fest. Can you tell us how everything went?
Ebert Fest 25. It was our 25th anniversary, and it was great. We've really created quite a community there in the Champaign-Urbana area over the years.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how when you started, when you kind of took the reins over and continued the legacy of Ebert Fest, what did that look like for you? And how has that progression been? Now we're in 2024 and looking back, what are some of the important dynamics that you really want to bring into Ebert Fest?
I've actually been involved with it from year one, so it's a little bit of a misnomer when people think I didn't become the host until after my husband, my late husband, Roger Ebert, got sick. But Roger and Nate Cohen, the festival director, and I worked together from the beginning of the festival. Roger was more the face of the festival at that time. I'm always trying to find activities where people can, number one, patronize more of the small businesses in the area around Champaign and Urbana. We also wanted to do more things with the community. For instance, one of my absolute favorite things is we had a gospel choir. We opened with a movie. It was a documentary about Aretha Franklin. And afterwards, the curtains closed. And when the curtains opened, we had a huge gospel choir from the local community. And people loved it. I mean, it was just one of the favorite things. find a way to incorporate more people from the community into the festival whenever we can, and from the university.
We have the Little Indian Girl Collective joining us later in this episode. And I wanted to ask you, how important is it to bring different voices in?
Absolutely love bringing different voices in. And even though we've done it from the beginning, I think we have done it more in more recent years. And this year, for sure, Malcolm D. Lee is the cousin of Spike Lee, and he brought his film Best Man, which was great. And I noticed that there were more African Americans in, because we sell individual tickets as well as passes. I noticed that there was a larger contingent of African Americans from the community. For the Little Indian Girl Collective, you know, you talked about Ginger Shankar. She is the great niece of Rabbi Shankar, who introduced the Beatles to North America. And her Little Indian Girl Collective with Tara Huska, it was just great. People really loved that because they also did a musical performance. I noticed that there were some students from maybe the Indian American Association there. So it's diverse voices are absolutely essential. If you're smart and you're curious, then you're curious about other people and other cultures, other languages, other food. I mean, it just makes sense to me in this world.
When I spoke with Malcolm Lee, I asked him about The Best Man and how it addresses themes of friendship and love and personal growth and accountability. I asked him how important it was for him when he was creating different films over his career. How important is it to explore universal themes within those contexts, especially within the African-American community and culture? So when you speak about integration and then bringing films who also talk about integration and show what this looks like in our communities, how do you think that can kind of echo out into the community as well? Or what's your take on that?
Well, first of all, a long time ago, and really it's really not all that long ago when you think about it, some films that showed Black life, for instance, would only show either very poor people or maybe people who had been traumatized. And what Malcolm Lee did with his film is he tried to show a really normal segment of Black life, but this is like an upper middle class and upper class Black life, of very, you know, people who are very successful working in TV, or the character played by Terrence Howard, I think, was hardly working at all. I think his dad had money, and Terrence Howard was trying to find himself. And the character played by Taye Diggs wanted Terrence to settle down and do something, not just live off of his privilege. So there are people within the African-American community who have always been wealthier than others. You need to show that, in addition to showing the middle class, in addition to showing people who are maybe, you know, blue collar. And I think you need to see all segments of humanity to see that we in society, we mirror it all socioeconomic levels. I love that movie.
Me too. And when I heard The Best Man was coming to Ebertfest, I said, oh, we have got to talk about this. Okay. And I know it brings a really nostalgic feeling to audiences. And I think it's great when you can just reflect on times of maybe how, when you first saw it, what were you feeling? And then how it relates to the present times as well. When you're curating the festival schedule, what does that process look like for you to say, okay, we want these diverse voices and we want these stories, we want to add a little bit of nostalgia? How do you mix and really curate
that process? You know, so it's been the same from the beginning. In the beginning, Roger, of course, had his ideas about which films he wanted. And both Nate, the festival director, and I, we had our ideas about which films we thought would be good for the audience. And we all would sit down and talk about them. After Roger passed away, Nate and I continued that process. We talk about every film. If either one of us would object to any film we're going to show, we wouldn't show it. Nate and I go to film festivals all throughout the year, you know, either Sundance or Telluride.
How do you get to be a movie critic? I guess my answer would be, I have no idea. With me, it was good luck. Right place, right time. I started going to the movies as a kid in Champaign-Urbana. I went to the Princess Theater on Main Street for the matinee double feature every Saturday. My Aunt Martha would take me to the movies over in the big palaces in Champaign.
After every film, we have a panel on stage. And we try to include some film critics, since Roger was a film critic. From the very beginning, we tried to incorporate some of his colleagues. And we also incorporate film scholars from maybe somebody from the University of Illinois or from another university. After each film, we have a panel to discuss the movies. And Malcolm Lee, I think we had Carla Renata, an African-American film critic, on the panel with Malcolm Lee, because she probably knew Malcolm Lee. I know she was very familiar with Best Man. And I think we had Nell Minow, one of the film critics who writes for RogerEbert.com. Malcolm, I wanted to get his insight, because that film, it has a great look and it flows very well. Do you know that was his first time directing a movie? No one can believe it. It's such an assured film, filmmaking that it's hard to believe it was his directorial debut. But one thing that I noticed he kept saying over and over, and he kept apologizing to the audience about, he said, "Oh man, I had too many just close-up shots. I had the camera so close. I should have pulled back more. I should have had wider shots, more anamorphic shots or something." But I didn't notice all of that. But once he said it about his film, I did look at other films after that and say, I wonder if they have too many close-up shots here.
How important is it for you that diverse groups of people from the Champaign-Urbana area or even outside of the area are coming to Ebert Fest?
Very, very important, because, you know, I was called on. Diversity is important not only for how we see the world, but how we begin to heal it. You cannot repair things. You cannot bring people together if you're only concerned about one group. You have to be concerned about the wider humanity. And I think the only way that you can do that and bring people together is by having some sort of empathy for someone who's not like you, so that you can understand these people who are, you know, on this journey through Earth with us.
What advice would you give to aspiring filmmakers, particularly those from underrepresented backgrounds, based on your own experiences curating film festivals?
The advice that I give, go out and do it. If you have a passion about something, write about it. Or if you have a camera, start filming. Don't wait for people to ask you, because almost nobody's going to knock on your door and say, "Will you please do this for me?" No, if you have a passion, you just have to do it. But the most important thing is to try to find something original to you. Something, if you feel you have something unique to say about an idea or a film, and if you can't do it by yourself, get a group together and do it. Just do it. Don't wait for somebody.
What does it mean to carry this legacy for Ebert Fest? And could you maybe give us, I know the festival just ended, is there a sneak peek about anything next year that listeners here on Dialogue or people who come to the festival can expect?
Well, Saturday night, I made an announcement that we don't know if there's going to be another Ebert Fest. I said, that doesn't mean this is the last one. It just means that I've been doing it for 25 years and I have to think about it. And it was just difficult. And so I wasn't going to make that announcement because we hadn't decided, but I felt that I had to say something. I had to let people know it's difficult and we don't know how many more of these there will be. Having said that and made that announcement, I started hearing from people saying, "We will help you. Let us know what we can do to help." And I'm really, really appreciative that people are reaching out and saying they will help. I've actually been so grateful to the community for welcoming the film festival. If we can come back and do another one, we'd love to do it, but we do need help.
Chaz Ebert, thank you so much for taking the time to come on to Dialogue and talking about Ebert Fest 2024.
Thank you. Thank you, Kennedy. And congratulations again on Illinois Soul.
Ooh, thank you. That was Chaz Ebert from Ebert Film Festival in Champaign-Urbana. Coming up, we will hear from one of our executive producers, Needy Shastri. She spoke with the Little Indian Girl Collective on their upcoming film, Promises of Our Grandmothers, as it debuted at Ebert Film Festival this year. They work with Black communities, Native communities, and often find unheard voices. This collective is made of filmmakers aiming to change that. More when Dialogue returns.
You're listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Needy Shastri. Before the break, we spoke with the CEO of EbertFest, Chaz Ebert. We're now shifting our focus to a conversation about a film she chose for the curation of the 2024 Film Festival. We're sitting down with the Little Indian Girl Collective, a community-driven storytelling collective.
The stories we usually hear are told by a chosen few, framing their narrow perspectives, telling us how the world is. They cast us as spectators, meant to sit by and watch it all burn. But it's time for a new narrative, one that highlights our voices and reminds us not only how the world has been, but how it could be. That's why we started Little Indian Girl Storytelling Collective, where women and Indigenous storytellers joining forces, skills, and resources to tell our stories on our terms. Stories from women who stand up and show us what reclaiming our power really looks like.
Their work ranges from covering climate-focused movements in the United States and anti-colonial movements in Ukraine, all the way to featuring street artists in South Asia fighting for women's rights and representation. Their upcoming documentary, Promises of Our Grandmothers, covers the stories of Indigenous activists working to fight a pipeline project in Minnesota. It, along with their other storytelling projects, was the center of the Little Indian Girl Collective's panel at EbertFest, titled Women Who Embody Revolution Through Storytelling. The women behind the panel featured at EbertFest include
Ginger Shunker. I am one of the co-directors of the collective.
Tara Hauska. I'm an attorney and founder of GNU Collective, and I guess the subject of one of these amazing coverages going by this beautiful media collective. And helping to produce, I think. That's my role.
And I am Erin Cook. I am the other co-director of the collective. And yeah, I'm excited to be here.
According to Ginger, she first met Tara at the Standing Rock Movement. Some background. The Dakota Access Pipeline was a construction project that was slated to run through Indigenous Sioux land called Standing Rock, located in North Dakota. By doing so, it violated a treaty agreement which guaranteed the undistributed use and occupation of reservation lands and threatened the tribe's cultural and environmental resources. Unfortunately, many of the activists protesting the pipeline at Standing Rock were met with violence.
Tara and I found each other about 8 years ago, something like that. I met her at Standing Rock. She has started an organization, Not Your Mascots. And so she was telling us about what was coming up with Enbridge's Line 3 in Minnesota in her homelands.
Enbridge's Line 3 is an oil pipeline that follows the Dakota Access Pipeline from Standing Rock into Minnesota. And just like the Dakota Access Pipeline, the construction project ran right through Indigenous lands. It was here that Ginger, Erin, and Tara first became the Little Indian Girl Collective.
When we went out there, day two, the camp was raided by police pretty violently and forcefully. And it was just very apparent. It was during the pandemic, so there wasn't a lot of media coverage going on compared to Standing Rock. And women, Two-Spirit folks, femmes, students that were coming in to help were all being assaulted. And it was pretty wild. So we just kind of started filming on our iPhones, and we just wanted to do a little interview with her to see what was happening, and kind of ended up staying and filming and just realizing, like, the story really needed to be told. So, yeah, that's kind of how it started.
And I think when Tara first invited us to her camp, it was this just incredibly eye-opening experiences for me personally, because I had not been to Standing Rock. I had just had a child, and I was sort of at home at that time. And so this was my first experience with a direct action camp. And seeing the care and the love and the laughter that existed within this very intense situation was just beyond inspiring. So that was really what got me excited to do this work.
At EbertFest, you all had a panel called Women Who Embody Revolution Through Storytelling. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, so we did a panel. Tara Hauska, myself, and Chaz Ebert moderated it, and it was just talking about all the different roles that women carry in environmental spaces and storytelling and so many different places that we really don't hear stories from. I think we're living in a time now with Palestine and the erasure of people in real time, and many of us have known our family members to go through that. We've known our histories to go through that, so it felt really important to have this collective and to start really uplifting stories of women around the world doing this work. And just also around that, to talk about community and how there's also a lot of joy around women. There's a lot of inspiration. And I think we live in such a crazy time right now where everybody's depressed and anxious and doesn't know what to do. And we're told that we can't do anything and the climate's burning. And you see women like Tara and you're like, she's standing up to like a $1 billion company. Of course I can do something.
The reach of the Little Indian Girl Collective is global. Ginger gave us a glimpse of some of the organization's projects, including their upcoming documentary, Promises of Our Grandmothers, along with a project surrounding the legendary Indian composer and sitar player, Ravi Shankar.
So we're working on Promises of Our Grandmothers with Tara in Minnesota. That's the first project. It's EP'd by Rosario Dawson. We're finishing that by the end of the year. And then we have the Fearless Collective, led by Shiloh Suleiman out of India, which are basically the South Asian Banksys, and these amazing women all over South Asia who set up murals and spaces that have been really violent for women. Our friend Elena Kovalenko, she is a Ukrainian filmmaker who basically went to Ukraine as soon as Russia started invading to tell the story of her people in the aftermath of war on women and children, which we don't usually see. We usually see the violence and let's be violent back. And I think telling the story of like what actually happens in these communities. There's a project in my family called Nari, which is a story of the Shankar women bringing Indian music to the West, telling the story of music and revolution of India into the West in the 1970s with George Harrison and Ravi Shankar.
Little Indian Girl Collective's reach is worldwide, but some of their most impactful movements have taken a hold right here at home. Along with being a part of the Little Indian Girl Collective, Tara's work includes creating the Not Your Mascot movement, a familiar topic for the University of Illinois, whose mascot, Chief Illini Weck, was officially removed in 2007. Despite its removal, the chief remains the center of protests and controversy on the university campus, with non-Indigenous people still dressing up in Indigenous attire for football games even today. Tara explained to us how her cultural and professional background led her to create the Not Your Mascot campaign and why it's so important.
So when I first stepped outside of my educational background and career into becoming a lawyer for Indigenous peoples across Turtle Island out in Washington, D.C., I was representing tribes all over the country on all kinds of different issues and had never really experienced what it's like to be in Washington, D.C. during football season, which at that time was the Washington football team. And so was very directly confronted with both simultaneously watching my people be dispossessed of rights and disrespected and very oppressed by the federal government and let down through the many, many things that make this country exist today, like the treaty obligations they have,
to then seeing people dressing up as us in the streets, like this caricature of us of face paint and headdresses and all of that, and just kind of seeing that dichotomy and lack of understanding and knowledge, like, really sat with me as a person coming from a place where I'd never really experienced anything like that before. Minnesota banned Native mascots back in 1992, so it was a really eye-opening experience to realize both the ignorance and the actuality of what happens when a people are dehumanized. I think, like, bringing this to this particular work that we're doing around environmental protection, I mean, I think people struggle to understand, well, no, I'm doing this because we were, you know, this is out of honor and out of respect and all that. When something, someone, is treated as a plaything that belongs to somebody else, that means you are entering a piece of dehumanization into that, right? Like, that means that I, therefore, like, don't have a say in what honors me, right? Like, it's whatever you decide and whatever makes you feel good. I don't think there's negative intentions behind a lot of fans, but that translates in so many different ways into dehumanization, into police officers showing up and engaging in horribly brutal acts against environmental activists and protectors and indigenous people and characterizing us as savage and using a lot of stereotypes to this very day that are very harmful for our communities.
What would you say to people who are kind of feeling this caring burnout or that sort of rising cynicism that we see in people who are trying to care but just seem burnt out by it all?
One part of the cynicism that people feel, I think we referenced it a little bit here, which was, you know, the pretty extreme state violence that we faced. At one point, we had a riot line, you know, show up in our dirt road and tell me that my driveway wasn't a driveway anymore to my private residence, right? Like, that happened, which I think you can look at it a couple of different ways. But one of them would also be they are obviously very, very afraid of people coming together, of a powerful community that was choosing to do something outside of the norm, that was choosing to defend the earth, that was choosing to be selfless and engage in acts of care and love for the earth and for each other. That in and of itself tells you so much about the actual power that we really do have. Yes, there is power concentrated, so-called power concentrated in certain spaces, but they are so afraid of the people and always have been, because none of this operates without all of us, right? Like, not any mechanism or being of the oligarchical system lives without us, right? Like, we actually do have the power and have the ability to make change. I mean, that's very clear, as we've seen through history.
And I think the cynicism just feeds into that. I think making people feel powerless is fully what they do. And just looking right now at Columbia students standing up for Palestine and being arrested, I mean, the entire world is standing up, and at some point they can't fight the whole world. So you just got to remember that. And I think the burnout comes from social media. Take breaks from social media, because at some point that doesn't help. I think that causes a lot of burnout for a lot of us. So take the break and then get right back in there. However you're going to help, you have to. There's no other planet. Well, there are, but not that we can live on at the moment.
Little Indian Girl Collective, thank you so much for sitting with us today.
Thanks for having us.
All of the work being done by the Little Indian Girl Collective can be found on their website, littleindiangirl.org. The music you hear now is Ginger Shunker's own work, titled Ode to Bombay, which she performed for the TED Institute. You can also follow them on Instagram under the handle @LIG Collective.
Dialogue's executive producers are Nidhi Shastri and myself, Kennedy Vincent. Contributing producers include our news and public affairs director, Reginald Hardwick. Dialogue's theme song is by Lamont Holden, and production assistance by Steve Mork. Dialogue is a part of Illinois Soul and Illinois Public Media. We are a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. If you want to learn more about Dialogue, you can stay up to date with us by following us on Instagram at Illinois Soul. Join us for our next Dialogue every Saturday morning at 11 and Tuesday nights at 7 on Illinois Soul FM 101.1 and WILL AM 580 Wednesdays at 8 p.m.